I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns and money. This shit has hit the fan.
Hello everyone, this is Bob Main, and you are listening to another episode of the Handgun World Show. Why do I carry a gun? Because I can't carry a cop. That's why. This is episode number 45, and if you are a relatively new listener, I want to let you know you've tuned into a practical show. I am not a gunsmith. I'm not ex-law enforcement or ex-military or anything like that. I'm just a private guy. I'm just a private citizen that likes to carry and shoot pistols. I believe in my Second Amendment rights to protect myself. So I just talk about practical experiences on this show. And even if you're an experienced shooter, you may get a couple of pearls of wisdom out of here, out of this show. And especially today, because I am going to talk today about becoming a process-oriented shooter. So I'm going to kind of appeal to some of you who have been doing this a while. Becoming a process-oriented shooter. And as you listen, you'll know what I'm talking about. Before I dive into that, I'm also going to do a little bit of a review on a certain type of handgun, one that I used to own and shoot quite a bit because a listener emailed me and asked me if I would do that. And, you know, that leads me to my next point, folks. This is your show. It isn't mine. I'm just the Yankee behind a microphone, okay? This is your show, so keep sending me feedback. One listener did, and I'm going to talk about that. Couple of announcements real quick. The website, handgunworld.com, handgunworld.com. If you're on iTunes, just search Handgun World Show and subscribe. I also, folks, just put up a new YouTube video. Check it out. I talk about how to travel with firearms, specifically how to take firearms on the airplane with you in your checked luggage, something that I do from time to time. So check that out. Go to the YouTube channel. If you go to YouTube and just search Handgun World Show, you'll see the video there. And you might also got an email from me announcing that as well. Okay, and the last announcement that I want to make is this is not my full-time job, folks. I have another job that I do all the time. I'm in sales. So this show pretty much exists. You'll notice that I don't make this show real commercial. You notice I don't have a lot of ads, and I don't spend, you know, 10 minutes talking about sponsors and stuff like that. I just try to keep this going on donations from listeners. So if this show helps you and you can support it, there's a donate button on the front page of the website at handgunworld.com, and that's all I'm going to say about that. All right, let me dive right into the main topic. Let's start with some listener feedback first. One person sent me an email, and he says, "Hello, Bob. I've been listening to your show for a few months now, and I must say you do an excellent job. I don't know what you do for a living, but you have a great voice, and your pace and timing are right on. If you're not professionally in broadcasting, you should be." And let me just stop right there for a minute. And, you know, I never thought about a career in broadcasting, sir. Thank you for the nice compliment. I very much appreciate that. This is broadcasting. This is internet broadcasting. So thank you, sir, and I hope you continue to listen, and I'll just keep trying to keep this show as conversational as I possibly can. And he says, anyway, I'm dying for you to do a review of the M&P pistol series. That's by Smith & Wesson. I'm a Glock fan at heart and own a few of them. The G19 is my favorite for reasons that you're well aware of. However, I'm fast falling in love with the M&P line. I recently purchased an M&P 9mm, and I must say the design and engineering are outstanding. I can't wait to hear your evaluation of these pistols. My wife also wanted me to thank you for giving me 1911 fever. She wanted to know if you're going to help me pay for it. I'm looking at a Kimber Pro Carry 2. Anyway, keep up the excellent work. Well, sir, thank you for that excellent comment. And yes, the G19 is my favorite, and I talk about that on the show, and most of you who've been listening a while know why. Let me go ahead and talk about the M&P series. I used to own a Smith & Wesson M&P 9 Compact. Another one of those guns I really wish I never would have sold. I ended up selling it to my brother, though, so we kept it in the family. But, I gotta say, folks, the M&Ps are really, really good pistols. M&P stands for Military and Police, and Smith & Wesson hit a home run. You know, Smith & Wesson took a lot of criticism for their Sigma series. I won't bore you folks too much on this podcast with that, but go back and look it up. But this M&P model is excellent. Very Glockish, but I got to tell you, they have really improved some things over the Glock. And you might find it surprising that I would say that, but yeah, there's some things about the M&P that are a significant improvement over the Glock. Having said that, there's also some things I don't like about the M&P design. For me, it's my opinion. I'll inject some of the opinion, and you can take it from there. So since I'll talk about a gun I used to own, folks, I don't like to do gun reviews if I haven't owned one or shot one. Let's talk briefly about the M&P 9C, and then I'm going to talk about being a process-oriented shooter. So stay tuned. As soon as I get done with this, talking about this particular model of gun, I'm going to get into some really cool shooting techniques that you might want to think about. But the M&P 9 Compact. Some people compare the M&P 9 to a Glock 26, but in my opinion, I don't think you should compare it to a Glock 26. I think you should compare it more to a Glock 19, because Smith & Wesson says this is their compact model. Well, a Glock 19 is a compact frame. A Glock 26 is a subcompact frame. But for purposes of this podcast and for purposes of argument, I'll go ahead and I'll compare the M&P 9 compact to the Glock 26, see what you think. All right, both of 9mm. The M&P has a little bit of an edge in capacity. The M&P is 12 plus 1. The Glock 26 is 10 plus 1 with the standard magazine. Barrel length. Barrel length is about the same. The M&P Compact, by the way, only has a 3.5-inch barrel length. The Glock 26 is 3.46 inches. So, you know, about the same. Now, the M&P really has a huge advantage over Glock in the sights. They give you some pretty good dovetail mount Novak sights on the M&P 9. The cheap plastic sights on the Glocks I really just dislike. But let me say something about sights. If you're going to keep the sights, the factory sights on a gun, yes, the M&P has a clear advantage. But most people end up changing out the sights anyway. The M&Ps by Smith & Wesson do not come with night sights unless you pay more. All right, the basic model does not come with night sights. So if you're going to change it out and put night sights on it, as you know, I'm a big fan of the XS Big Dot sights, then this is really a non-issue. But I guess you could give the edge to the M&P on that. Trigger pull. Let's talk about that. 6.5 pounds for the M&P, 5.5 pounds for the Glock 26. Now, while I'm on the subject of trigger, and folks, I'm not going to bore you with a whole lot of statistics between these two guns, but a couple things I want to point out. The trigger on an M&P actually doesn't travel as far as it does on a Glock. It's a shorter trigger travel. Okay, from start to finish, it is a shorter trigger travel. But here's one of the things I didn't care for. Now, your mileage might vary, but I didn't care on the M&P 9 for the reset. The reset of the trigger was not that positive click that you get with a Glock. It didn't have that crisp reset to tell you, hey, you've reset the trigger on this, and that's very important. To me, in combat and speed shooting, that's highly important. You can definitely feel it when the Glock trigger resets. With the M&P, it's kind of faint sometimes. Now, you can modify it. There's a lot of good people who work on guns, work on M&P guns. Burwell Gunsmithing up in Pennsylvania. When I had my gun, I sent it up to him. I had him do a trigger job on it. And he really sent it back with a really nice, crisp reset. I highly recommend Dan Burwell's work. He's very, very good. And there's an outfit in Oklahoma City that does it, too, that's pretty good that I've heard. But, again, then I'm modifying a trigger that is a carry gun. The M&P Compact was a carry gun. If you're competing with the M&P, it's in the stock service pistol category and in the production pistol category in USPSA, stock service pistol in IDPA, so you're good to go there. It does have an ambidextrous magazine release button, so for you lefties, you'll really like the M&P for that reason. Let's talk about weight, because for a carry gun. Weight's real important. The M&P is 2 ounces heavier than the Glock 26. M&P Compact, 21 ounces. Glock 26, 19 ounces. couple of ounces. And then when you add extra ammo that the M&P holds, it is going to be a heavier gun. The overall length, it's a half an inch longer than the Glock 26 as well. Now, you might not think that that's a whole lot of extra length, but all this stuff starts adding up when you're talking about a conceal carry gun. The slide release lever is very much superior on the M&P. I really like that. It's a double sprung gun. The recoil spring is a dual recoil spring, which is good. Recoil is very, very manageable on the M&P. Very, very soft shooter. You can put excess big dot night sights on it, which I like. The accuracy on the M&P is outstanding. Here's a big biggie. Interchangeable backstrap. Something that Glock just can't seem to wrap their brains around. But they finally did. The Generation 4 Glocks now have an interchangeable backstrap. I don't think there's a whole lot of Generation 4s out there. I could be wrong. But finally, Glock got with it. Now, Smith & Wesson M&P gives you three different backstraps. I guess Glock is doing that now, too. The warranty. Let's talk about the warranty on the M&Ps. You know, Smith & Wesson on all their guns give you a lifetime warranty. That's good. Lifetime warranty. Can't beat that. To the original owner. Warranty on a Glock? You don't need it. I mean, you don't need a warranty on a Glock. Enough said. But it is an advantage to the M&P. Last point I want to make about the Smith & Wesson M&P is about holsters. Actually, 2 points. Holsters and spare parts. There are plenty of holsters out there now for the Smith & Wesson M&P. They've gained popularity. They have won a couple of law enforcement contracts, several of them. So a lot of holster makers are jumping on board. Still, though, much more limiting than holsters for a Glock 26. Holsters for a Glock 26 are never ending. I mean, there's got to be hundreds of thousands of holsters out there for a Glock 26. Okay, now, let's talk about one of my big hot buttons. Those of you who've been listening to my show for a while, you know I'm big on this. Spare parts. Spare parts. I look at things from a survival mentality. I'm a survival kind of guy, okay? I like to look at all the different scenarios. What if, what if, what if? I'm positive, but I like to look at things from a survival mindset. I believe in having lots of spare parts. It ain't easy buying and collecting spare parts for the Smith & Wesson M&P. So I'm going to have to give Glock the big edge on that one. And it's also not nearly as easy to do your own work on an M&P as it is on a Glock. So that's something to really consider, folks, because you can buy Glock parts just about anywhere. It's not easy to buy Smith & Wesson M&P pistol parts. Okay, so I just thought I'd throw that in there. But other than that, these are outstanding guns. The M&P was originally built on the 40 caliber design. So for you 40 caliber shooters out there, for you fans of the 40 cal, the 40 Smith & Wesson, well, this gun was built on a 40 caliber platform. It was built with the 40 caliber in mind. Glock was built with the 9mm in mind, and then they expanded it to the 40. Some people think that's kind of a weakness. I haven't found it to be a problem, but some people do. It's a very soft shooting 40 caliber. The one I owned was 9mm, but I did rent a 40 caliber, ran 100 rounds through it. Not bad. Much more controllable than a Glock 22 or a Glock 23 in 40 caliber. So you can get that big bad 40 caliber round, and you can probably manage it pretty well with the Smith & Wesson M&P. I also like the fact that it does have a nice low bore axis. As a matter of fact, it's almost as low as a Glock. In other words, it sits down low in your hand, which is very, very important for combat shooting. So, another big plus. Fine guns, folks. I would carry an M&P if I couldn't carry a Glock. Let me say that. Okay? I would carry an M&P by Smith & Wesson if I couldn't carry a Glock. So I can definitely see why they're selling a lot of guns. My hat's off to them. So, sir, if you already own an M&P, I can't remember if your email said you already own one or you're thinking about buying one, very, very good choice. I just think that compared to its counterpart, the Glock 26, just a bit heavy for me. Just a little bit too big and heavy for that kind of gun. I can put on my Glock 19 and have a longer barrel and more capacity and so forth. But otherwise, very, very fine gun. Okay, let's shift gears into the next segment. I have an audio clip I want you to listen to. Folks, sometimes I don't want to do all the talking. I want you to listen to an audio clip. Now, I'm going to play for you an audio clip by it was on CNN. And I want you to listen to this anchor woman on CNN just get schooled on gun rights. I mean, she just got taken to the cleaners. I don't know if you guys heard this news report, but I think it was about a year and a half ago or so, a car dealership in Missouri decided to give away guns with the purchase of a car. And at first they started giving away handguns, and then they changed it to giving away AK-47s with the purchase of a car. I'm not kidding you. I'm going to play you this soundbite. Listen to this. Now, even though that might sound a little ludicrous to you, what? Give away a gun with the purchase of a car? Listen to the overall message of this soundbite. And listen to this car dealership guy just take this lady from CNN to the cleaners when she starts to give him a hard time about giving away guns with the purchase of a car. So go ahead and listen to this. I got a few comments for you when we come back. Here you go.
American Morning, the most news in the morning, period. Weekday 6 Eastern.
Well, last year we gave away a free handgun with the purchase of any vehicle, and it went over very well. It spiked our web traffic. We sold we estimate 35 extra cars during the promotion than we normally would have. And this year we're trying to sell an extra 100 cars more than we normally would. We're just trying to generate some traffic, generate some interest and enthusiasm and excitement, and it seems to work real well. We're not just going to give people an AK-47 gun. You know, felons buy cars too. What we are going to do is we're going to give them a voucher where they can go to their local gun dealer, and or we have local gun dealers we would strongly recommend, where they can go buy a gun and go through the proper background checks, and so that, you know, the guns end up in the right hands.
So how much money does an AK-47 cost? I'm just curious.
It depends. You can get a good AK-47 for $450, maybe $500.
You know, some people watching this might think, you know, owning a handgun is one thing, but owning an AK-47 is something else, and maybe this is just a tad irresponsible?
It's a little grandstanding, but how about that guy that just had him and his wife killed that had the 12 children with the 7 guys coming through the door? I guarantee you he wishes he had an AK-47 as those maggots busted through his door and slaughtered him and his wife in front of his children.
Well, but
others... The purpose for guns like AK-47s is home defense.
Well, but police officers are shot in the line of duty all the time and they carry guns every day, so maybe some might not think that's a great argument.
Well, I'd personally like to have a sporting chance instead of just becoming a victim. I guarantee you those guys that broke through that door that used guns to kill those people did not have legal guns and did not go through the proper steps to get them. Those were all illegal guns, and I would bet my bottom dollar on it. I haven't seen the facts yet, but mm-hmm. Look, there's a bunch of evil in the world, and people need to protect themselves. We're real firm believers. We're country folks down here. We live down here, and we're real firm believers in the Second Amendment, and we don't want to become victims. When I live out in the country 15 miles from the dealership here on 1,200 acres, the response time to my home is about 15 minutes. And if I'm counting on the police, and we have a great police force in Bates County, great sheriff, great police in Butler where we live, response time still 15 minutes to how great the people are, how good their intentions are. And I would rather defend myself. The only 911 call I need is chambering around.
Well.
And I think that's the case.
You know what? I grew up in rural America too. We had guns in our home, but they weren't AK-47s. I mean,
how long ago was that?
When I was a teenager. What's 20 years ago, 30 years ago?
Things have changed dramatically. I don't know if you know anything about Missouri. Where I live in this county, there's a tremendous crime problem with people doing meth. And these people they've lost their souls. They don't care about you, they don't care about me, they care about one thing, getting more dope.
Well, I understand evil in the world, but I'm just questioning like a semi-assault weapon to protect yourself. That's all I'm saying. Your motto is God, guns. Your motto is God, guns, guts, and American. Why did you come up with that particular motto?
Actually, it's God, guns, guts, and American pickup trucks. Because we sell cars.
Right, but you include God in that. And, you know, some might wonder why God is included in a motto that it also includes guns.
You don't have a problem with God, do you?
No, I don't. But
I'm
the combination
curious.
Some people
well,
might, between God and guns, some people might have a problem with that.
We're a Christian nation. We're Christian people. I believe that 70-80%, I would guess, in this nation would classify themselves as Christians. I'd say 90% of the people in this country are believe in God, whoever their God is, and to try and remove God from everything, I think is a huge mistake.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
I don't think
God in a motto that also includes guns might be a little upsetting to some people.
You don't think God wants us to defend ourselves? I'm confused.
I don't know. I could ask you the question, you know, we could do the what would Jesus do? Would he carry a gun?
No, they didn't have guns back then, but I do believe he'd carry a sword if he needed it. But he was so powerful, he didn't need any weapon.
That is true. Thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Mueller. We appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. Hey, I appreciate it.
Okay, I don't know about you, but I'd like to buy a car from that guy. I think his advocacy for the Second Amendment is just great to hear. It's right on. I applaud this guy. I think it's great. I know you might think, that's a little strange giving away guns with the purchase of a car. Yeah, maybe it is, but I just like the way he ate up that lady from CNN that was trying to give him a hard time. So I thought you'd enjoy that. True story, folks. One thing I never did find out that I'd like to know how many cars they actually sold on that promotion and how many guns that they actually gave away. Okay, now let's talk about becoming a process-oriented shooter, which is the main topic of what I wanted to get into in this podcast. I don't know if you ever heard of a guy named Bruce Gray. Bruce Gray, an excellent Sig Sauer shooter, and just an excellent, phenomenal shooter. Very well respected. Has a gunsmithing business called Gray Guns. In July of 2009, he wrote a really good article. I'll put a link to the article in the podcast. I'm going to paraphrase some of what Bruce talked about. I actually read this article not too long after it came out in the summer of 2009, and I took it to heart. And what I'm about to tell you right now, I've actually done, and I've done it a lot. And folks, it really, really improved my shooting skills. I mean, it dramatically improved my shooting skills. I'd love to be able to meet Mr. Gray and shake his hand and say, way to go. Because, you know, I have a mentor, folks, that taught me a lot about mindset. Not shooting mindset. He taught me a lot about just overall mindset for life. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is building the mindset for being a shooter. And a lot of it is what my mentor taught me years and years and years ago when I was a young adult, about just developing the competence level, the unconscious competence level, where you can do things and you don't even have to think about it. Okay? That's called unconscious competent. You don't even have to think about what you're doing. It's just automatically second nature. Shooting is no different. Shooting is no different. So Bruce Gray calls this becoming a process-oriented shooter. So let's dive right into it. There's three categories of good handgun marksmanship. Here you go. If you're taking notes, you might want to pause this, get something to take notes with. Three categories of good handgun marksmanship. Number one, aiming. All right. In other words, getting your right, the correct sight picture. Number two is trigger control. And number three is tactical gun handling, like reloading and so forth. All right. Most of what I see out there and what I've experienced myself that contribute to shooting errors are usually trigger control related. Okay, now there's a lot of shooters that like to say, well, my groups weren't very good because I had bad aim, or I got bad vision, or I didn't have the right grip. It's usually trigger control related, folks. Blaming your sights is ridiculous. Okay? Unless your sights were incorrectly installed or they're the wrong size for your gun, it's not the sights. Okay? The sights are doing what they're supposed to do. You know, and when it comes to sights, it really depends on what it is you want to do. Do you have target sights on the gun, or do you have combat sights on the gun? But either way, most of the time the sights do what they're supposed to do, unless they're improperly installed or they're the wrong size. So for purposes of this podcast, for purposes of this argument, let's assume that the sight installation and the size are correct. I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say that everyone has the ability to see and focus on their sights, and they can hold that alignment of those sights well enough to shoot a real tight group. But once it comes to pulling the trigger, that's where all hell can sometimes break loose for a shooter. Okay, good shooters have the ability to press the trigger well enough to exploit the aiming skills I just talked about. And note I said press the trigger. Some call it squeeze the trigger. I didn't say pull the trigger. Now, this is psychological. I want you to understand this real carefully. Listen to what I'm saying. I didn't say you pull the trigger. You press or you squeeze the trigger. I want you to get in the habit of thinking press or squeeze. Don't think pull. Okay? Because the problem is when you think pull, psychologically, unconsciously, you may jerk the trigger. And that's what happens. And that's a real bad thing if you want to be an accurate shooter, is jerking it. Okay? This is why I'm a big fan of dry fire practice. I'd say dry firing is far more important than almost any other single thing you can do to build your shooting skills. Most modern pistols today, dry firing is not going to hurt them. Matter of fact, there's dry fire kits you can buy, and there's snap caps you can buy, and so forth, if you're really worried about hurting your gun. But poor trigger control is definitely going to hurt you, especially if you're in a real fight. Okay? So let me talk about flinching for a minute, okay? The dreaded flinch. It's the demise of almost any shooter. And shooters flinch basically occurs for two primary reasons. And Mr. Gray talks about this. And when I really got into this and I started thinking about myself, that's when I realized how true this is. Number one, one of the biggest causes of shooters flinch is performance anxiety. Performance anxiety. Just by its very nature, shooting is an exercise in what's called self-realization. The bullets either hit or miss. Whether it's a little bit or a lot, they either hit or miss. And everybody wants to do well and not look like an idiot in front of other people. Now, I'm going to say something I don't want anybody to take the wrong way, please. But it's a fact. Women are usually less prone to succumbing to this type of performance anxiety. And in fact, a lot of women do better in marksmanship shooting and in training because they're not as susceptible to the same performance anxiety. Whereas men do tend to become more ego-involved in the results. Sorry to say that, guys, but it's true. Sometimes that ego works against men and their skill development. And I'm guilty of that. I'll go ahead and throw my hand up in the air. I'll admit to it. Especially when I'm in a shooting match. Men sometimes let their ego get in the way when they're shooting in front of women, too. You ever notice that? Let me tell you a story. I was at the range a few weeks ago, and I saw a guy trying to teach his wife or his girlfriend. I don't know what she was, a wife or a girlfriend. He was trying to teach her how to shoot, and she was shooting better than he was. And I could read the look on her face, you know. She was almost saying, without actually using the words, "Hey, Joker, my groups are tighter than yours. Leave me alone." Okay, but he was trying to be macho man and show her how to do it, and he was screwing up. Okay, there are very few things in American society that fill the ego-driven nature of humans than shooting a gun does. And the reality of it is, shooting's actually pretty easy. But far too often, the shooter has a high personal investment. In other words, ego in the results of their shooting, and that makes it difficult for them. So that's one of the causes of shooter flinch, is that performance anxiety. The second is what we call shooter's wobble. Everybody wobbles. Okay, your sights are never just going to sit there motionless and in perfect alignment all the time. Yet our egos tend to make us perfectionist. And people who are perfectionists, results-oriented shooters, they won't accept their wobble. And they're disappointed in the lack of immediate success. Oh my God, the rounds are just not going exactly where I'm aiming them. They're just not going there. And they get frustrated. They're frustrated by that overwhelming will to be perfect. And then they jerk the trigger. And they flinch and they miss. And that frustration of the bad bullet placement comes from overthinking what they're doing. Okay? And they're getting clumsy. Be careful not to overthink your shooting. All right? Just do what you think should be done. There's a lot of shooters just have not trained enough to ingrain good techniques into their subconscious mind. And my mentor taught me about ingraining techniques into your subconscious mind. Okay, which presses or squeezes the trigger when they see the aligned sights on target. But the impatient shooter, the impatient results-oriented guy, he jumps on that trigger as soon as he sees the sights lined up. Bam! He jumps on that trigger and wants to shoot it right now. And then the gun recoils, and then it worsens the problem. And then there's a blast from the gun, too. Right, which is another reason why they miss. And the blast and the recoil worsens his problem. He starts jerking it more. Jerking the trigger, I'm talking about. You know, the good Lord didn't design us to tolerate an explosion 18 inches in front of our eyes. Guns were man's idea. So that shooter wobble also becomes a problem. Okay, now getting down to process-oriented shooters. What I call a process-oriented shooter, they develop a sense for what they have to do to fire a good shot on a given target at a given distance. And they train their subconscious minds to do just that. All right, note I did not say that they train themselves to make a perfect shot. I'll say that again. They develop a sense for what they have to do to fire a good shot, not a perfect shot. Perfect shots are usually not possible every time. And certainly in a self-defense or combat shooting situation, you're probably never going to get a perfect shot. And perfect shots probably aren't even desirable for you to strive for in a real-life sense self-defense anyway. All right? Your goal is going to be able to put as many rounds on target and stop that bad guy. You don't just have to place it. You don't have to place it within a 1-inch group on the bad guy. You understand? Just be able to hit your target and hit it frequent and hit it often. Okay? So let me define what an acceptable shot is. An acceptable shot is one that puts the bullet within a reasonable target area for the application of the type of shooting. In other words, a self-defense shooting, the reasonable target area, the acceptable reasonable target area, is probably going to be the torso area, also called center of mass. All right? Now, there's a couple shooting tricks I want to share with you. A couple shooting tricks about getting it into that acceptable area. But I'm going to hold off just for right now, just for a couple minutes. I'm going to hold off talking about those tricks. I just want to review a couple things and then we're going to have a brief intermission here. I'm going to try a little something different here. I'm changing up the format of this podcast a little bit. I just got done covering the Smith & Wesson M&P. I talked a little bit about that, how it compares to a Glock, and I talked about the three categories of good handgun marksmanship: aiming, trigger control, and tactical gun handling. And I'm right in the middle right now of talking about one and two: aiming and trigger control. And shooters flinch, and how to avoid it. And basically, performance anxiety and shooters wobble is what causes the flinch, or accentuates the flinch. And a process-oriented shooter learns to get real good by developing that unconscious competent level. So, I'm going to get into these two tricks that I want to share with you. But first, let me take a little bit of an intermission here. You know, you've probably noticed that that I start off this podcast with a song by Warren Zevon called Rollin' the Headless Thompson Gunner. So I'm going to go ahead and play the whole thing in case some of you are wondering if you've never heard this song before, or maybe if you have, it might be a good throwback to the old days. Take some time now to think about what I said, to digest it, to put it into your mind. Go ahead and do some rewinding if you want, whatever you feel like doing, or just take some time to clear your mind right now. Listen to Warren Zevon. I think this was back in 1974 or 1975 when he recorded this. Rollin' the Headless Thompson Gunner. I'll play the whole song for you, and then I'll be back, and I'll talk to you about a few tricks in putting those shots in the acceptable target area. So here you go. Here's Warren Zevon.
Roland was a warrior from the land of the midnight sun, with a Thompson gun for hire, fighting to be done. The deal was made in Denmark on a dark and stormy day, so he set out for Biafra to join the bloody fray. Through 66 and 7 they fought the Congo War, with their fingers on their triggers, knee deep in gore. Days and nights they battled the Bantu to their knees. They killed to earn their living and to help out the Congolese. Rollin' the Thompson Gunner. Rollin' the Thompson Gunner. His comrades fought beside him, Van Owen and the rest, but of all the Thompson gunners, Rollin' was the best. So the CIA decided they wanted Rollin' dead. That son of a bitch Van Owen blew off Rollin's head. Headless body stalking through the night in the muzzle flash of Rollin's Thompson gun. In the muzzle flash of Rollin's Thompson gun. Rollin' searched the continent for the man who done him in. He found him in Mombasa, in a ballroom drinking gin. Rollin' aimed his Thompson gun, he didn't say a word, but he blew out Owen's body from there to Johannesburg. Rollin' the Headless Thompson Gunner. Rollin' the Headless Thompson Gunner. The Headless Thompson Gunner.
Talking about the man.
Rollin' the Headless Thompson Gunner.
The eternal Thompson Gunner, still wandering through the night. Now it's 10 years later, but it still keeps up the fight. In Ireland, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Berkeley, Patty Hearst heard the burst of Rollin's Thompson gun and bought it.
Okay, folks, I was wrong. While that was playing, I looked it up. It was 1978 from the album Excitable Boy. That's Warren Zevon, the Rollin' the Headless Thompson Gunner. A little bit about that song. Warren Zevon met the co-writer of that song in Spain, and Roland is a Norwegian who becomes embroiled in the Congo crisis of the late 1960s, and he earns a reputation as the greatest Thompson gunner. And he attracts the attention of the CIA and so forth. And he's betrayed and murdered by a fellow mercenary, Van Owen, who blows off his head. So Roland becomes the phantom headless Thompson gunner. And that's always been a catchy song that I've always liked, so that's why I choose to use it on this show. All right, the two shooting tricks that I want to share with you that I got from Mr. Gray's article. For IDPA and other practical shooting scenarios, the process of making an acceptable shot varies. You got to judge the distance, the target area, your position, and how long it takes to make the shot and so forth. Some shots require a lot harder sight picture than others. Some of them require a hard sight picture, a perfect clean trigger break, and a perfect follow-through. Other shots, other acceptable shots, just require a quick slap of the trigger. All right, just a quick slap of the trigger while you're on the move, for example. And training your mind to select and apply the right technique for each shot is the first trick I want to share with you. It's the first trick of becoming a good shooter, knowing when do I have to take a real hard sight picture and concentrate and get that perfect clean trigger break and follow through, and when can I just basically point that gun at the target and slap that trigger, find my front sight and slap that trigger. Okay, so that's the first trick. The second trick is an old technique that one of my mentors taught me. You heard me talk about him earlier. In the sales training business, one of my mentors taught me. And this principle I'm going to teach you applies to learning to shoot as well. Have the patience to let your highly trained mind apply the correct shooting technique for the appropriate situation so that it becomes a reflexive response. I'll say that again. So that it becomes a reflexive response. Your shooting should be reflexive. In other words, what I'm trying to say is you shouldn't have to think about it. It's an automatic reflexive response because you've practiced it so much, your mind and your body simply engage together in one reflex response. Okay, so you can automatically tell yourself, do I have to get a hard, clean sight picture here and make sure I get a perfect, clean trigger break? Or can I just put that front sight on center of mass and slap that trigger? Which one? Now, guess which trick is harder to master? It's harder to master making it a reflexive response. You guessed it. It's harder to become the unconscious competent where you don't even have to think about it. You just react to whatever situation that you're in, whatever shooting situation that you're in. Now, there's a third element to this. I guess I probably should have said that there's three tricks here. Perfectionism can work against you. Some people say perfectionism can be counterproductive. And I agree with that sometimes. Here's what I mean. I also believe that a lot of shooters out there handicap themselves by being too much in awe of what other people do and the way other people are shooting. They see other people who have greater shooting talents than they do, and all of a sudden, oh, wow, look at that. Can you believe that he or she did that? The result of that is you convince yourself that you can't shoot as fast and as accurately as that person can, and it's not true. You can do it. And I do this a lot, folks. This is something I struggle with. I psych myself out way too much when I see other process-oriented shooters that are doing a good job shoot a stage before me and shoot great because they've practiced it hundreds of times and it's become a reflex response. It psychs me out sometimes. Too often, we stay comfortable in our little self-imposed comfort zone of skill, and we accept that mediocrity. And sometimes it's way too uncomfortable to extend ourselves out of that comfort zone and try something that's harder. But the champion shooter, the champion differs only in the fact that she knows that her comfort zone is just an illusion. Her comfort zone is fake. And when she gets out of that comfort zone and she gets a little uncomfortable and tries to perfect something a little bit harder, That's when growth occurs, and that's the third little trick, is not letting yourself get psyched out. And don't accept mediocrity. Say, hey, I can do better. That's why you hear me talk about folks all the time when I go to an IDPA match. I'm not really there to win the match, but I'm there to beat myself. I'm there to do better than the last time I showed up. Because if I start to compete against the other shooters there, if I start to compete against people who have done it hundreds and thousands of times that are better than me, I will psych myself out. And then I won't grow. I'll just stay in that comfort zone of mine, and I'll just say, well, this is the best I can do. I'm just going to have to accept it. I fight that all the time. Okay? Now, I'm not talking about shooting an aspirin at 50 feet. You ever seen that YouTube video of the guy doing that? I'll try to find that and post a link to it. For right now, I just want you to hit something, some kind of an area reliably. Just focus on hitting something on the target reliably. All right? Maybe it's a 2-inch dot at 10 yards. Does that sound reasonable? Okay, you think you can practice putting a target out? Let's say 7 yards. How about a 2-inch dot at 7 yards? Now, for a brand new shooter, even that might be daunting. And it might be a little bit out of their comfort zone. But that's a realistic goal. That's reasonable. Not hitting an aspirin at 50 feet. That's just way too unattainable. Don't try to do that. You know, I see a lot of new shooters that will go to the range and they'll practice their plinking. And they'll roll that stupid target out all the way to like 20 yards. And they're frustrated because they don't have a 1-inch group at 20 yards and they barely even shot their handgun. That's just way too realistic, folks. Don't do that. Okay, so assuming that your sights are aligned fairly well, and you can see that blurred 2-inch dot somewhere beyond your front sight, then you can hit that 2-inch target area almost every time, as long as the trigger is pressed, not pulled, correctly. All right, and that's going to lead me into one of the final points I want to make before I close the show. The fundamental skill of how to press and trigger control. Okay, to get good trigger control, I want to talk to you about visualization. All right, let's start with visualization. Okay, visualize a sight picture on a target in your mind while simultaneously pressing through on the trigger. Okay, here's what I mean. First of all, unload your gun. Check it 3 times, make sure it's unloaded. Okay, let's say you're shooting a 1911. Okay, you might be able to easily drop that hammer without moving a dime that's sitting on the top of your slide. Take a dime, put it on top of your slide, pull the trigger, drop that hammer. The dime should not move. Okay, same thing with a Glock pistol, M&P, XD, I don't care. Practice doing it so that the dime doesn't move. Okay, you need to have an unshakable faith in that skill and that ability to be able to gently squeeze the trigger. Okay, you also need to have an equal faith in your ability to call each shot and know where it went based on what the sights did after you fired the shot. Okay, so let's get back into visualization. Okay, visualize a picture on a target in your mind, like I mentioned. Feel the trigger and notice what it does when you pull it. How does it creep? How does it wiggle? Okay, try to pull that trigger and get as close to dropping the hammer, or if you have a Glock or some other striker-fired gun, pull the trigger until it's almost ready to fire and hold that trigger and watch what's happening to your sights. Okay, don't be looking at your target right now. Just be looking at what your sights are doing. Watch the sights and see if you see that front sight dip a little bit or jerk or do all kinds of weird things. If you do, that's not good. Now squeeze the trigger a little bit more until, bang, the gun fires. In other words, it's an unloaded gun, okay? This is dry fire. But until you hear that trigger fire the gun or you hear that hammer drop, okay, just squeeze it until you get to that point. And imagining the gun recoil and so forth. Great, now that's good. Now, let your visualized shooting session seem like it's real. and allow yourself to come back to the sights, focusing on the front sight, align it, and then press the trigger again. All right, be focused on the process of operating the trigger and learn to press that trigger gently without any convulsions in your hand or jerking or anything like else. Okay, remember, your gun's a thing, it's a device, it's a machine. It's a machine you own and it's a machine you control. Your gun does not control you. That's something else I want you to understand. You control the gun. The gun does not control you. If the gun does control you, maybe it's too much gun for you. You've heard me talk about before many times. Find a caliber that you can shoot and control. Okay, so this visualization dry fire practice that I just shared with you, do it for 2 weeks. Do it for 2 weeks, about 10 or 15 minutes each day for 2 weeks. Or at least until you can press that trigger without making the dime move and when the hammer falls or when the striker fires the gun. Okay? Now, dry fire practice should be something that you do all the time. Okay? And even when you think you're getting good, even good shooters continue to dry fire practice and they practice on the basics between competition and range sessions. Okay, the purpose of this visualization and dry fire practice, because when you get to the range, you'll fire the gun just like you did when you were dry firing in your living room with the unloaded gun. Okay, when you're dry firing, what you're doing is you're actually telling yourself what you're going to do when the gun is loaded. Another trick here is that you need to allow your subconscious mind to do the shooting for you. Okay, since that's what you practice, trust yourself. After a couple weeks of dry firing drills, you got it. You got it. You just need to let it out on the shooting range. Okay, you just have to occupy your ego with something safe, something that it can do to help you rather than letting it take you over. Okay, so give your ego a job. Make your ego watch the sights, especially the front sight. Tell it to focus intensely on that front sight and not to think of anything else. Okay, don't even focus on the target at this point. Don't worry, the target's not going to go anywhere. All right, don't focus on the gun. All right, just you know, your gun is zero. Don't worry about it. Your gun is accurate, okay? Don't worry about that. Just focus on the front sight. Align the notch just as you visualize. Press and squeeze that trigger. Okay, now, I'm about to say something now that's very controversial. And that's okay. If you disagree with me, you've heard me say many times, I welcome disagreements. Have a good reason for disagreeing and send me a comment, throw it on the blog, on the forum, whatever. I'm not going to chastise you for disagreeing with me. Most highly skilled shooters use the sights all the time. And they use them every time as they need to make a given shot. Now, there's a lot of tactical gurus out there, a lot of gun writers, and a lot of people that are going to tell you that true practical shooting is not about the sights. Okay? They'll say things like the whole concept of point shooting. Point shooting is all that you need to do. Now, I'm going to take a point shooting class. Okay, point shooting is basically not even using the sights. Point shooting is basically learning to train yourself so well that you can point the gun and put rounds on target. And I'm going to take a class on that. But I think that just relying strictly on point shooting and not your sights, I think that's praying to a false god. That's praying to a false idol. There is only one true God, and that's God. And your front sight is a safe thing to master and regard with complete obedience when it's time to shoot. Whether you're shooting at paper targets or aspirin tablets, rely on the front sight. Okay? Use those sights. The reason I'm going to take a point shooting class is not so I can learn a skill to depend on to save my rear end. The reason I'm going to take a point shooting class is to see what I actually can learn to do without using the sights. Because if I can learn some instincts, if I can develop some instincts without using the sights, it'll make me that much more effective when I do use the sights. And this is why I'm such a big fan of XS big dot sights. Because that large big dot is very easy to pick up. And that large big dot in front could very well save your hiney in a gunfight. Okay? So, I don't believe in just strictly relying on point shooting. I'll be doing some podcasts and some reviews of the point shooting class that I'm going to take in May. But my purpose to go there is to make my shooting with my combat sights even better. Now, I'm going to bring this show to a close in just a minute. But I want to talk about light trigger pull for a second. Okay, and this is another point that Bruce Gray makes in his article, which I think is a very good one. Okay, yeah, a 1.5 pound trigger does help you slap that trigger without grossly affecting your sight alignment. Yes, it helps, but there's a negative to super light triggers, and this is why I'm not a big fan of them. The negative is that it only allows trigger slapping. That's it. It makes it almost impossible for most shooters at a slow or a moderate speed when you need to be real precise. It's really tough. That light trigger actually makes it harder. Okay? The reason it makes it harder is it can easily cause you to fire off a round unintentionally when you don't want to. Before you've got that sight on target, you could fire off a round. I've done this in a match. My trigger was too light on one of my Glocks, and I actually fired before I wanted to, and that reduced my accuracy. It's happened to me on more than one occasion, so I quickly changed out all the parts in my Glock back to the factory trigger pull, or just very, very, very slightly reduce it. One thing I like to do on my competition gun only, I don't do this on my carry gun. I do change out the trigger return spring on my Glock, and I put in a stronger powered trigger return spring. If you understand the way a Glock works, by putting in an overpowered trigger return spring, it actually just, it lightens the trigger pull just a hair. But I don't do this on my carry gun. All right, leave your carry guns just the way they are out of the box, in my humble opinion. Okay, but in closing, there's really only two ways to shoot. One way is reactively, where the sight picture is read on some kind of a conscious level. And the other way to shoot is proactively, where your sight picture is remembered on a subconscious level. Okay, your conscious mind tends to focus on what just happened in the past with the previous shot. It doesn't focus on the present. And you adjust yourself for the present shot that you're about to take. And if you've ever wondered why some top shooters can do things that they can do, it's based on just what I just got done telling you. All right? Because they have burned it into their subconscious mind what they're supposed to do. And it becomes a reflexive response. It's something they don't have to think about. It just automatically is part of them. And I'm not even close to being there yet. Okay, I'm a reactive shooter. I'm trying to get to the proactive level to where I don't have to think about it, to where I'm unconsciously competent and it just becomes second nature to me. So, with that, I'm going to go ahead and bring the show to a close, folks. You may have to go back and listen to this once or twice because this is kind of scientific, psychological stuff here. And I hope I didn't bore you and I hope I didn't get too carried away with it. But I'll put a link. You need to read Mr. Gray's article. It's an excellent one. So, thank you for listening to episode number 45, folks, of the Handgun World Show. My name is Bob Main, and why do I carry a gun? Because I can't carry a cop. Good luck. Safe shooting, everybody. Check out my YouTube channel. I just put another fresh YouTube video on there about how to travel with your handgun, specifically on airplanes, and how to properly put it into your checked luggage. Okay, folks, thanks for listening to episode 45. Catch you next time. Bye-bye.
I'm hiding in Honduras. I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money. This shit has hit the fan. Guns and money.